fentanyl would have had serious consequences for the world financial system, but may also have empowered the people of Africa or something. The US wants to avoid all costs.
Welcome to Tando Radio Show. My name is Scotty Reed, broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. Dave is not here today, so I'm filling in for him on this April the 7th, 2017, on this Friday evening. Hope that your week has been productive. Mine's been pretty productive. Got a lot of things done this week. All right, so let's get into today's program on Tando Radio Show. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention that we do have Brother Braggs, who will be sitting in, and we'll be learning from him about a couple of things. And so make sure that you keep it locked right here. Brother Braggs will be joining us once we get through what's in the news. Remember, you can support the production and distribution of independent black media with a tax-deductible donation to the Black Talk Media Project. You can find our organization's website online at blacktalkmediaproject.org. Black Talk Media Project is actually the manager of Black Talk Radio Network. Also, if you're interested in a new online social community, a community that was set up for the listeners of Black Talk Radio, please check out btrcommunity.com. It is a subscriber-based social media network. It is just $24 a year. So check that out. That's btrcommunity.com. All right, let's go ahead and jump into what's in the news. Dave has a couple of articles that he has posted for today's program. I'm going to go through those, and once again, we'll then be turning the program over to Brother Braggs. Also, let me just go ahead and get the telephone numbers out real quick before we get started. If you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call at 866-510-9025. Hit star to unmute yourself. Please watch your background noise. Again, that telephone number is 866-510-9025, and it is star to unmute yourself for questions or comments. The first article that he posted comes from SputnikNews.com about the S-400, the Pantsir air defense system protecting the Russian air group in Syria 24/7. There's pretty much a theme with his news articles for today. As y'all may have heard, Donald Trump launched a illegal airstrike on a air base inside of Syria. I was actually just before the program listening to a segment on the Real News Network, as they had an international law scholar on, and she was saying on all counts, under international law and U.S. domestic law, that was an illegal strike, and that she agrees with Representative Barbara Lee. I believe Barbara Lee is out of Texas, if I'm not mistaken. And she called it an act of war against Syria. So this article about the S-400 protecting the Russian air group in Syria says military and intelligence, the S-400 and the S-300 and the Pantsir air defense systems protect the Russian air group at the Hymenium airfield from the air, the Russian ministry said. The Russian air defense system in the Syrian Arab Republic is aimed at protecting certain facilities and objects. So this pretty much kind of explains why they launched $60 million worth of Tomahawk missiles at this base inside of Syria, because if they had sent planes to do it, they would have gotten taken out by these air defense systems. The next story, Beijing is concerned over Filipino President Duterte's order to deploy troops in the South China Sea. This comes to you also from SputnikNews.com. On Thursday, Duterte reportedly said he ordered the deployment of military forces onto 9 Philippines claim islands in Reese in the South China Sea and announced his intention to raise the Philippines flag on Pagasa Island in the Spratly Island chain. Again, that's from SputnikNews.com as the situation continues to escalate in the South China Sea. Next story. This comes to you from PressTV.com. PressTV.ir. Putin, U.S. strike illegal, seriously hurts Russia-U.S. ties. President Vladimir Putin believes a U.S. missile attack on a Syrian air base near Homs has violated international law and seriously hurt Russia-U.S. relations, the Kremlin says. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Friday that the Russian leader regards the U.S. attack as an act of aggression against a sovereign nation, which was carried out based on a made-up pretext. So, again, going back to the international law scholar that was on with Paul Jay on the Real News Network, under international law, there are two instances where you can attack a sovereign nation in the manner that the United States just attacked Syria. Number one is with a UN Security Council resolution. That did not occur. Number two, as an act of self-defense, meaning in this case, that means that Syria would have had to attack the United States, which is pretty impossible, considering they don't have the military assets to launch such an attack on the continental United States. So in light of those two standards under international law, I think it's clear that Donald Trump's administration just violated international law on terms of domestic law. An act of war requires a declaration of war from Congress. But again, this is why I tell people, don't come at me with any kind of we're a nation of law and order, because these people don't pay attention to their own laws. They violate their own written laws all the time. They are a bunch of outlaws, if you ask me. So next story. This comes to you from Russia-Insider.com. Trump says he now has responsibility to start World War III in Syria. Donald Trump is now Hillary Clinton with a better wig. Via CNN, President Donald Trump, speaking at a news conference on Wednesday, said the chemical attack against Syrian civilians crossed a lot of lines for me and changed the way he views Syria and leader Bashar al-Assad. I mean, just based on those comments right there shows you that this guy isn't really all that intelligent. He is not stupid, but he is also not very intelligent, not very analytical. He seems to operate a lot off of emotions and news headlines, you know, regardless of whether those news headlines have any truth to them or not. I'm just sorry. This all reminds me of 9/11. You know, within 24 hours after the 9/11 attacks here in the United States, they already had identified the perpetrators of the attack. So I'm like, you know, how all these people saying, oh, yeah, Syria did it. Syria did this. Syria gassed his own people. I would ask you, what would be why? What would Assad have to gain? And he would have everything to lose. I mean, they are, along with help from the Russians, from the Iranians, They already beating them terrorists using conventional weapons. Okay, so it just makes no sense to me that they would jeopardize public opinion by using banned chemical weapons. But again, within 24 hours, without an investigation, Donald Trump orders the launch of $60 million worth of Tomahawk missiles into Syria. All right, so, and also Hillary Clinton, I wish she had got lost in those woods. But now she's cheering on Donald Trump and saying that, oh, this was absolutely the right thing to do. I will remind you that Hillary Clinton's emails that were leaked show that she wanted to ramp up military, what would we call it, intervention or military aggression in Syria solely on the behalf of Israel. That's in her emails. And if you ask me, that's suspect number one for for use of these chemical weapons, possibly Israel. All right. So let me continue on. Time.com. This article comes to you from Time.com. This is the last article, and then we'll turn it over to Brothers Braggs. Russia is angry, but don't expect Putin to fall out with Trump over Syria. When Russian President Vladimir Putin got word that the U.S. cruise missiles were going to strike his Syrian ally early on Friday morning, he had several options, both military and diplomatic, for firing back. He could have used Russia's air defense systems in Syria to shoot the American rockets out the sky. Now, I don't know if they could do all of that, take out missiles. These are air defense systems designed to take out aircraft, so I don't know if I'm agreeing with this person. And again, this all just happened. So I'm sure that the Russians are being pragmatic and discussing with their allies what their response is going to be. I would like to see what the UN response is going to be. Again, the United States operated illegally with this attack, did not have a UN security resolution in place authorizing the attack, and the United States was not attacked by Syria. So this is, again, another egregious violation of international law, which the United States is a serial habitual offender. All right, that's the last story that Brother Dave posted for you today. At this time, I want to turn it over to Brother Braggs.
Peace,
Brother Braggs.
All right. I'm going to begin today by reading from a couple of things that I found very interesting. I hope you find them interesting as well. I'm going to give you the title of the book. And the first book will be Michael Bradley, The Highest Man of the Inheritance. I'm just going to read you, for educational purpose, just a couple of excerpts from this particular book. I got a couple of books I lined up. But first, I want to balance my energy around here so I could begin. So peace. All right. The first thing I'm reading from is this Iceman Inheritance, Michael Bradley. And I'm starting from the introduction. I found this very interesting. Hopefully we will also. Excuse my animals. This is usually the time that I move everybody around, but they have to wait today. 1250 BC, depending on your source, with the publication of books of folklore, the Odyssey and the Iliad credited to the author named Homer, who we have little information about in the book, A History of the Modern World by R.R. Palmer and Joel Colton. They tell us that Europeans were by no means the pioneers of human civilization. Half of man's recorded history had passed before anyone in Europe could read or write. The priests of Egypt began to keep written records between 4000 and 3000 BC, or more than 2000 years later, the poems of Homer were still being circulated in the Greek city-states. By word of mouth, shortly after 3000 BC, while the pharaohs were building the first pyramids, Europeans were creeping, creating nothing more distinguished than huge garbage heaps. Ironically, like the pyramids, they still endure and are known to archaeologists as kitchen mittens. At the time when the Babylonian king Hammurabi, about 2000 BC, caused the laws of complex society to be carved on stone, the most advanced Europeans were people like the Swiss lake dwellers, simple agriculturists who lived in shelters built over the water to protect themselves from beast and man. In a word, until after 2000 BC, Europe was in the Neolithic or Stone Age. This was in truth a great age in man's history, the age in which man learned to make and use sharp tools, weave cloth, build living quarters, domesticate animals, plant seeds, harvest crops, and sense the returning cycles of the months and years. But the Near East, Egypt, and Euphrates and Tigris Valley, the island of Crete, and the shores of the Aegean Sea, which belong more to Asia than to Europe, had reached and passed the Neolithic 2,000 years before Europe. When Europeans finally got themselves together and created the semblance of what would be referred to as a state of a nation, they soon made a grand discovery. Europe could not furnish them with enough food to properly feed them or enough material to properly clothe them. They began to look with covetous eye at the more developed parts of the world. Soon they would find a rationale for their initial military aggression under young Macedonian Greek known in history as Alexander the Great. He would invade North Africa in the year 332 BC, following the invasions from Western Asia by the Assyrians in 666 BC and the Iranians in 550 BC. These invaders and their ruthless administrations would cause the Africans of North Africa and the Nile Valley to cry out, in effect, "Oh God, if you do not send us a liberator, send us a conqueror who will show mercy." Alexander did show mercy. He also showed he was a great diplomat, greater diplomat than he was a warrior. As a conqueror, he did what conquerors do. He raided the granaries of Egypt to feed his soldiers and his armies, continued the bastardization of Egypt that was started by Western Asian invasion in 1675 BC, forced cohabitation with the woman, changed the population and the cultural temperature of the declining Nile Valley civilization. Alexander's and the Greek conduct in Africa was more arrogant than racist. Some of the racism that we know today did have its genesis in the Greco-Roman period, although this racism can in no way be compared with what Europeans have experienced at the hands of Europeans for the last 500 years. With the military raids of Rome and the decline of Greek military power after Alexander, the Romans were determined to control the trade of Mediterranean and had no intentions of sharing this trade with the Carthaginians, who had built one of the most advanced commercial cities of the world of that day. The Roman conquest of the large area of North Africa and the consolidation of the conquest with the death of Hannibal and the end of the Punic Wars would install the Romans as the dominant power in the Mediterranean for the next 500 years. Because of the stubborn refusal of white scholars to read books like Stolen Legacy by George G. M. James, published in 1954 after the Origins of Major Western Religions by Dr. Yosef Ha Ibn Jahaki, published in 1970, The Destruction of Black Civilization, where issues of race from 400-500 BC to 2000 AD by Chancellor Williams, published in 1974, Ages of Gold and Silver by John A. Jackson, published in 1991, white scholarly pretenders who are often authorities on things they know little or nothing about are not aware of the earthly European intellectual dependency on North Africa and Western Asia. They are also not aware that most of the so-called Greek philosophers not only studied in Egypt, but consulted Egyptian texts on a regular basis. According to Theopal Obinga in his work, The Pharaonic Origins of Greek Philosophy, published in 1990, the word philosophy is not Greek, of Greek origin. This European practice of attributing the achievements of other people to themselves started during the Greco-Roman period and continued to this day. The racism that plagues us today had its origins in the second wave of Europe in the 15th and 16th centuries. During this period, the Europeans referred to as the Middle Ages of Dark Ages. Europe had lost their previous skills in seafaring, and the concept of longitude and latitude had been also lost from their memory. They came out of this period in history, according to Professor Leonard Jeffries of City College of New York, land poor, people poor, and resource poor. The European established the slave trade and used it to begin its economical recovery. After the Crusades and the famines and plagues that had arrested attention of Europe for over 300 years, Europe's self-concept was damaged. Since 711 AD, the year of the African Arab conquest of Spain, Europe had been held by at bay by what they referred to as the Haitian infidels. African Arab armies in the North Africa and in the Mediterranean area by the continuous rise of Islam. Europe began to break out of this bond in the 1400s with the port assault on the city of Creta in Morocco in 1415 and again in 1455. When in settling an argument between Portugal and Spain, the Pope authorized Portugal and Spain to reduce to servitude all infidel people. Most of the declared infidels were African and Asians. This was the official rationale for the Atlantic slave trade. During this period, Europeans not only began to colonize most of the world, they also colonized information about the world. They colonized the Bible. They colonized all complementary images of non-European people held of themselves. The most effective of all of these colonized images was their colonization of the image of God. The missionaries, adventurers, freebooters, and slave traders, they began to propagate the concept of God, favored them over other people. They were saying, in essence, that all Europeans were the chosen people of God. Often in their teachings about God, they ran into a contradiction. They taught of a God who was king and loved mankind, who was no respecter of kin or kin. By pretending that God had favored them over other people, they had made God into a bigot. They had made God ungodly. Most of the non-Europeans had misconceptions about the Europeans' relationship to Christianity then, and have the sum of the same misconceptions now. Europeans have a tendency of proclaiming ideals to the world that they do not believe themselves and would not dare to live by. If they are going to hold power over most of the people of the world, the war on non-European culture had been going on before the emergence of Europe, now continued, mainly under European control. The Europeans were not telling their victims that the world waited in darkness for them. The Europeans were now telling their victims that the world waited in darkness for them to bring the light, where in actuality, everywhere the European went outside of Europe, he put out the light of his victims' culture, spiritual, and cultural way of life. Not only did he not understand their culture, he had no intention of understanding their culture. Europeans declared war on the culture, on the structure of every society they invaded or were welcomed into as visitors. Many societies that the Europeans pretended to civilize would have been better off had the European left them alone. In Africa, the Pacific Islands, and in large areas of mainland Asia, people had built a safe and spiritually endowed society before the first European wore a shoe or lived in a house that had a window. In large areas of Africa, a cluster of civilizations were built without an organized jail system or a word in their language which meant jail, because there was no need in their society for one. There is a need to look at European racism in the opening of the so-called New World. The best way of the early recorded accounts come from Father Bartholomew de Las Casas, who came to America on the third voyage of Christopher Columbus. When Columbus noticed the rapid disappearance of the natives of America over the time of the three visits, he would go to de Las Casas and request that he petition the Vatican for an increase in the Latin slave trade, with the pretense that this increase would save the souls of the Native Americans. De Las Casas is considered the first historian of the New World. His account of mass murder and disappearance of the natives of the New World, mistakenly called Indians, is entitled The Devastation of the Indies. A brief account was published in 1974. Father de Las Casas' account of the island of Hispaniola, Haiti, and the people he observed there is as follows. All the land so far discovered is a beehive of people. It is as though God had crowded into these islands the great majority of mankind. And of all the infinite universe of humanity, these people are the most guileless, the most devoid of wickedness and duplicity, the most obedient and faithful to their native masters and to Spanish Christians whom they serve. They are by nature the most humble, patient, and peaceable, holding no grudges, free from embodiments, neither excitable nor quarrelsome. These people are the most devoid of rancors, hatred, or desire for vengeance of any people in the world. And because they are so weak and compliant, they are less able to endure heavy labor and soon die of no matter what malady. The sons of nobles among us, brought up in the enjoyments of life, refinements are no more delicate than are these Indians, even those among them who are of the lowest rank of laborers. They are also poor people, for they not only possess little, but have no desire to possess worldly goods. For this reason, they are not arrogant, embittered, or greedy. Your father, there's Las Casas' account of the people in Hispaniola is true, and I believe it is. What excuse can the Spanish Christians offer for the wholesale torture and murder? This Las Casas goes into a detailed description of continuous annihilation of Indians in the occupation and destruction of civilizations of Mexico. Further, in his books, he describes the occupation of the Indians in this matter. They were very clean in their persons, with alert, intelligent minds, open to doctrine, very apt to receive our holy Catholic faith, to be endowed with virtuous customs, and to behave in a godly fashion. Yes, into this sheepfold, into this land of weak outcasts, there came some Spaniards who immediately behaved like ravaging wild beasts, wolves, tigers, or lions that had been starved for many years, and Spaniards have beheaded in no other ways during the past 40 years down to the present time, for they are still acting like ravenous beasts, killing, terrorizing, afflicting, torturing, and destroying the native people, doing all this with the strangest and most very new methods of cruelty never seen or heard of before, and to such a degree that this island of Hispaniola, once so populous, having a population that I estimated to be more than 3 million, has now a population of barely 200 persons. The island of Cuba is nearby, is nearly as long as the distance between Valladolid and Rome. It is now almost completely depopulated. San Juan and Jamaica are two of the largest and most productive and attractive islands. Both are now deserted and devastated on the northern side of Cuba and Hispaniola by the neighboring Batallos, comprising more than 60 islands, including those called Gandies, besides numerous other islands, some small, some large, the least besides... Okay. The least felicitous. Okay, I'm messing up, guys. F-E-L-I-C-I-T-O-U-S, felicitous. I can't pronounce it. Forgive me. Of them, were more fertile and beautiful than the gardens of the King of Seville. They had the healthiest lands in the world. There lived more than 500,000 souls. They are now deserted, inhabited by not a single living creature. All the people were slain or died after being taken into captivity and brought to the island of Hispaniola to be sold as slaves. Racism with its accompanying fear and frustration was the cohesive force that held the plantation system together. It created a new way of life for the European and the Caribbean islands and the Americans over and above any amount of creature comfort they would have endured in Europe. At the same time in history, the Europeans who were successful in Europe generally stayed in Europe. What was referred to as the New World was brought into being by a large number of people who were failures at home. It was once said that Europe dumped its human garbage can into the New World. In spite of some exaggeration, there is some truth in this statement. Many of these Europeans felt called upon to make non-Europeans feel inferior so that they could convince themselves that they were superior people. The physical resistance against European dominance and the need and greed that influenced their attitude and personally started in a formal way early in the 18th century, and after there were anti-colonial revolts. The Africans were fighting to regain what slavery and colonialism had taken away. In the Caribbean islands and in South America, the Africans on a different geography and under different circumstances were fighting for basically the same thing. There are 250 recorded slave revolts in the United States alone. The people of Asia have been reacting against occupation and domination almost from the beginning of the European presence in their country. They had a different land mass to deal with and a different political situation, but they were fighting against the same thing. Early in the 20th century, the world began to witness the military raids of modern Japan. In the Russo-Japan War in 1905, the Japanese were strong enough to match their military power against a major European nation and win. Racism against Asians, although with some variations, was radically different from racism against people of African descent and was spreading worldwide with the stereotyping of Asians, mainly Chinese, in the early movies. While the cry against the yellow peril was direct against the Japanese, after the Russo-Japanese War, it was generally direct against all Asians. This matter is reflected in great detail on the book, The Revolt of Asia, by Upton Close. published in 1927. One of his comments worth repeating here is, having witnessed the wide sweeping reverse swing of the pendulum against white dominance in Asia today, especially as shown in the revolt in China, it is now time to turn back from the presence to charge with the motion of impending and fundamental change to examine first the broad contacts between the races which accumulated in the white man's world, and second, the successive steps which have recently brought his supremacy of the verge of collapse, the one question upon which the human creature is perhaps even more ignorant than where he is going is where he came from. We are most totally ignorant as yet of even the meaning of race. Differing nations into racial stocks are approximate and uncertain. The one principle upon which all ethnogenesis seem to agree is that any people were ever found will certainly have come from somewhere else. Upton Close states further in his book about the origin and end of the Yellow Peril, the final great eruption of the barbarian push flaring westward through Russia into Central Europe as well as driving southward upward. China was dramatically enough what abruptly awakened self-centered Europe to the existence of other half of the world. The military machine perfected by Genghis Khan swept through the feudal Russia as far as Vienna. No resistance of Pechepi, not the cavalry of Europe, but the decision of the Mongol commander to go home and attend the funeral of dead Khan and share in the inheritance, save Christendom from the same iron heel which left such terrible scars of oppression on the soul of the Slav. This was the origin of the Yellow Peril. Scare of fright, which now seems almost as congenial instinct in the West. This era was followed by the spread of scientific racism and widespread propagation of Teutonic origin theory. Early in the century, the elder scholar among African Americans, Dr. W.E.D.D. Du Bois, said, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. Unfortunately, his prophecy was correct. In spite of all the talk in sociology, good and bad, we have not made much progress in resolving this issue. We have talked about it extensively without really dealing with it. To deal with it, we have to ask ourselves some hard questions, and we will have to be boldly honest with our answers. Some of the hard questions are, how did racism start in the first place? And for whose benefit was it created? Who benefits from it now? Why do we lack the strength or the courage to destroy it? In this introduction, I am dealing mainly with the form of racism that affects people of African descent in a speech delivered to the Pan-African Students Organization in the Americas, New York City, November 1964. Richard B. Moore observed, in an attempt to justify the conquest and enslavement of African people, European rulers and their spokesmen found it expedient to regard and set forth Africans as being of low and brutish order, who indeed were hardly human. Such creatures then were deemed to have done little or nothing which could be defined as history. The dehumanization of the African people had already been started. The false images were already in motion. The stereotype and mental images of savage Africa in the Dark Continent were deeply impressed upon the minds of the Europeans. The distortions were repeated until some of the victims began to believe it themselves. In his books, Race, Science, and Humanity, published in 1963, Dr. Assi Montagu refers to the belief in race as a widespread contemporary myth in the Western world. He further states that it is the modern form of the older belief in witchcraft. The point of view is extended in the following quote from the introduction to this book. I am convinced that when the intellectual history of our time comes to be written, the ideal of race, both the popular and the taxonomic, will be viewed for what it is. A confused and dangerous idea which happened to fit the social requirements of a thoroughly exploitative period in the development of Western man. The ideal of race was developed as a direct response to an exploitation of other peoples to provide both a pretext and a justification for the most unjustifiable conduct, the enslavement, the murder, degradation of millions of human beings. European interest in formalizing the concept of race dates back to the early part of the 18th century. Dr. Montagu maintains that the development of the ideal of race may be traced with some justification back to the scholastic neutralization of Aristotle's doctrine of predictable genes, species, difference properly, and doctrine and accident. In the year 1457, hold on, I skipped a line. Forgive me, let me go back. Start over. European interest in formalizing the concept of race dates back to the early part of the 18th century. Dr. Montague maintained that the development of the ideal of race may be traced with some justification back to the scholastic naturalization of Aristotle's doctrine of predictable genes, species, difference, property, and the accident. In the year 1457, the Council of Cardinals met in Holland and sanctioned as a righteous and progressive ideal the enslavement of Africans for the purpose of their conversion to Christianity and to be exploited in the labor market as chattel property. He further maintains that the concept of race had another development during the early days of the Age of Enlightenment, when in 1735, Scottish botanist Linnaeus took over the concept of class, species, and genus from theologians to serve them as systematic tools. These conclusions show how important it is for us to deal with both the genesis and the present application of racism. This devilish scheme speedily became the standard policy of the church for three centuries, and thus the ghastly traffic in human misery was given the cloak of respectability and anointed with the orb of pontifical righteousness in Jesus' name. And so the slave trade began inaugurating an era that stands out as the most gruesome and macabre example of man's disregard of the humanity of all men. There is no way to understand the African slave trade without understanding slavery as an institution. Slavery is almost as old as human society. Every people had at some time or another been slaves. In fact, Europeans enslaved other Europeans for much longer than they enslaved Africans. This slavery did not give birth to racism, but it did lay the basis for feudalism. European racism had manifested itself in many dimensions outside of Europe. And what is called the Holocaust is just European racism turned inward toward itself, with Europe making Europeans the scapegoat of other European people. Slavery was a permanent feature in the ancient world. In Egypt, Kush, Greece, and Rome, the African slave trade is better known to us because it is the most recent and best documented. Now, I don't agree with a lot of this, but I'm going to read it because these are not my words. Okay. The African slave trade is better known to us because it is the most recent and best documented. The Christians of European descent have never felt at ease in an honest discussion of this subject because every examination will prove that slavery and the slave trade were the incubator for present-day racism. The Christian church was the handmaiden of the development of racism. While they propagated the theory that all men were created equal in the sight of God, and practice it found all sorts of arguments to prove that non-European people, especially black, were inferior and could not be considered as men in the general sense. A search for ways to justify European domination led biologists to the works of Linnaeus and Buffon. Thus, the classification of races began. And in deciding the distinction between the high and the lower races, Europeans, of course, became a hierarchy of races. In many ways, this was a continuation of the rationale set up to justify the slave trade. The African slave trade, like African history in general, is often written about and rarely understood. There was at first a concerted effort to obtain labor to open up the vast regions of the New World. It is often forgotten that in what became the United States, white enslavement started before black enslavement. In an article, White Servitude in the United States, Every Magazine, November 1960, the African-American writer Leon Bennett Jr. given the following information about this period. Some removes the cataracts of whiteness from our eyes, and when we look with unclouded vision on the bloody shadows of the American past, we will recognize for the first time that the Afro-Americans, who were so often second in freedom, were also second in slavery. Indeed, it will be revealed that Afro-American was third in slavery, for he inherited his chains, in a manner of speaking, from the pioneer bondmen who were red and white. Forced labor was widely used in England. This system was transferred to the colonies and used to justify a form of slavery that was visited upon red and white men. concise information on this system and how it developed is revealed in the book Slavery and Abolition, 1831-1841, by Albert Bushell Hart, first published in 1906. It was decreed that the apprentice must serve his 7 years, take floggings as his master saw fit. The hired servant must carry out his contract for his term of service. Convicts of the state, often including political offenders, were slaves of the state and sometimes sold to private owners overseas. The colonists claimed those rights over some of their white fellow countrymen. A large class of redemptioners had agreed that their service should be sold for a brief term of years to pay their passage money, and of indentured or indented servants brought by their masters under legal obligation to serve for a term of years and subject to the same penalties of branding, whipping, and mutilation as African slaves. These forms of servitude were supposed to be limited in duration and transmitted no claim to the servant's children. In spite of these servitude, the presumption in law was that a white man was born free. The English settlers at once had begun to enslave their Indian neighbors, soothing their conscience with the argument that it was right to make slaves of pagans. And look, this is what I don't agree with, because these Indians are you and me. That's why I don't agree with it. So just so you know, when they just say Indian, they kind of throw you off. The indigenous people of America are you and I, but that's another subject. The English settlers at once had begun to enslave their Indian neighbors, soothing their consciences with the argument that it was right to make slaves of pagans in large numbers. The Indians fled or died in captivity, leaving few of their descendants in bondage. This virgin soil of the New England settlements continued to need more labor. This led to a fierce search for white labor that subsequently led to a search for black labor. Now remember, the first slaves in the colonies were indentured bondsmen and indentured servants, and they were Caucasian or whatever they were, but they weren't copper color and they weren't African. So these were all Europeans. So the first slaves were European. S-L-A-V, remember, the first slaves were Slavs, and they were enslaved by the Germans, not Africans, not the melanated people of America. Okay. Forgive me. That was what I had. Oh, a large class of redemptioners had agreed that their service should be sold for a brief term of years to pay their passage money, and of indentured or indented servants brought by their masters under legal obligation to serve for a term of years and subject to the same penalties of branding, whipping, and mutilation as the African slave. These forms of servitude were supposed to be limited in duration and transmitted no claim to the servant's children. In spite of this servitude, the presumption in law was that a white man was born free. The English settlers at once had begun to enslave their Indian neighbors, soothing their conscience with the argument that it was right to make slaves of pagans in large numbers. The Indians fled or died in captivity, leaving few of their descendants in bondage. They want you to lead you to believe that the Indians all died off. Okay. The virgin soil of the New English settlements continued to need more labor. This led to a fierce search for white labor that subsequently led to the search for black labor. American abolitionists, both black and white, began fighting against a form of racism that had begun to crystallize itself in the embryo of colonies' educational system, filtering down from the attitude prevailing in the colonies' churches during the period of the founding fathers. The African-American heard promises about democracy and liberty and justice and did not know that these promises were not meant for them. They deluded themselves into thinking that they were but the African. Soon learned that Africa was not brought to this country to be treated democratically, and the American promise was not made to him. This was the dilemma during the formative period of this country. It is the basis of the dilemma now. This country was born in racism, and it has evolved in racism. In the early years of the 19th century, the system of chattel slavery gave way to colonial system. This was not the end of racism as it affected Africans and other non-white people throughout the world. It was only the radical change in how it would be manifested. The European would now change the system of capturing Africans and other non-white people and enslaving them thousands of miles from their homes. They'd enslave them on the spot within their own countries and use them as markets for new goods coming out of the developing European revolution and out of their countries and their labors to produce grist for new European meals. The industrial risks rays of the West has its base a form, has at its base a form of racism. Racism helped to lay the base of the present economic system we now call capitalism. In the main, theoretical racism is a 19th century origin in America and in Europe. And yet the 19th century was a century of the greatest resistance against racism. It was during that century when Africans the world over began to search for a definition of themselves. The high watermark of the Africans' reaction to European racism came in the middle of the 19th century in the presence of great black intellectuals such as Martin R. Delaney and Edward Wilmot Bateman. Toward the end of the 19th century, the great intellectual giant W.E.B. Du Bois took up the fight and ably carried it into the middle of the 20th century. This is now an international struggle against racism on the part of people of African descent. The struggle has been taken to the world's campus, the theoretical basis of racism started. This has helped to create new battle lines and a lot of fear and frustration on the part of white scholarship. Their fear prevents them from recognizing that the renewal of racism that they created is the healthiest thing present-day black scholarship can contribute to the world. The important contribution that Michael Bradley has made to this subject is in the realm of alarmists, calling attention to what has already happened and what needs to be done about it. Western racism is a disease that has affected the whole world. Its aftereffect might, in the final analysis, do more harm than good to its creators. This book is not a masterpiece of a scholarship or analysis. The content of this book, The Iceman Inheritance, is an important message for our times and all times if we have the hope of creating a world free of war, race, hatred, and tension. His inquiry into this subject has bold admissions and revelations which invariably open doors and put subjects on our intellectual agenda for investigation. In my opinion, this is the meaning of this investigation and the essence of this contribution to the subject of race in a changing world. And this was the Iceman Inheritance. I just found that very interesting. Now, the next book that I'm going to jump into right quick, and all I'm doing is doing a quick reading out of a few books I found very interesting. And this one right here, now this is Behold a Pale Horse, William Cooper. And this is Top Secret Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, an introductory programming manual, Operations Research Technical Manual SW7905.1. Okay, and this, here we go. Welcome aboard. This publication marks the 20th anniversary of the Third World War called the Quiet War, being conducted using subjective biological warfare, fought with silent weapons. This book contains an introductory description of this war, its strategies, and its weaponry. May 1979, number 74-1120, security. It's patently impossible to discuss social engineering or automation of a society, i.e. the engineering of social automation systems, silent weapons, on a national or worldwide scale without implying extensive objectives of social control and destruction of human life, i.e. slavery and genocide. This manual is in itself an analog declaration of intent. Such a writing must be, this is for educational purposes only. This is just stuff I read, and I'll give you the book so you can follow the book if you want. That's Behold a Pale Horse, William Cooper. And I'm in the chapter right now, chapter one, Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. Okay. It's patently impossible to discuss social engineering or automation of a society, i.e. the engineering of social automation systems, silent weapons on a national or worldwide scale without implying extensive objectives of social control and destruction of human life, i.e. slavery and genocide. This manual is in itself an analog declaration of intent. Such a writing must be secure from public scrutiny. Otherwise, it might be recognized as a technically formal declaration of domestic war. Furthermore, whenever any person or group of persons in a position of great power and without full knowledge and consent of the public uses such knowledge and methodology for economic conquest, it must be understood that a state of domestic warfare exists between said person or group or persons and the public. The solution of today's problems requires an approach which is ruthlessly candid and no agonizing over religious, moral, or cultural values. you have qualified for this project because of your ability to look at human society with cold objectivity and yet analyze and discuss your observations and conclusions with others of similar intellectual capacity without a loss of discretion or humility. Such virtues are exercised in your own best interest. Do not deviate from them. William Cooper, author's note, all above emphasis are mine, as are those in the following two sections and including bracketed additions. I do recognize this document based upon document's own mission as a formal declaration of war. Okay, historical introduction, silent weaponry, technology has evolved from operational research, a strategic and tactical mythology, developing the military management Eisenhower and Ian during World War II. The original purpose of operation research was to study the strategic and technical problems of air and land defense with the objective of effective use of limited military resources against foreign enemies, i.e. logistics. It was soon recognized that those in positions of power, the Council on Foreign Relations, that the same methods might be useful for totally controlling the society, but better tools were necessary. Social engineering, the analysis and automation of a society requires the correlation of great amounts of constantly changing economic information, data, so a high-speed computerized data processing system was necessary, which could race ahead of society and predict when society would arrive for capitulation. Relay computers were too slow, but the electronic power invented by in 1964 by J. Pesper Eckert and John W. McCaughey filled the bill. The next breakthrough was the development of the simplex method of linear programming in 1947 by mathematician George B. Danzig. Then in 1948, the transistor invented by J. Barton, W. H. Bratton, and W. Shockley promised great expansion of the computer field by reducing space and power requirements. When these three inventions under the direction, those in positions of power strongly suspected that it was possible for them to control the whole world with a push of a button. Immediately, the Rockefeller Foundation got in on the ground floor by making a four-year grant to Harvard Choice Funding, the Harvard Economic Research Project, for the study of the structures of the American economy. 1 year later, in 1949, the United States Air Force joined in. In 1952, the original grant program period terminated, and a high-level meeting of the elite Illuminati were held to determine the next phase of social operations research. The Harvard projects would have been very fruitful, as is borne out by a publication of some of its results in 1953, suggesting the feasibility of economic social engineering, studies in the structure of American economy. Copyright 1953 by Wesley Lintiff, International Census, Press Inc., White Plains, New York. Engineered in the last half of the decade of the 1940s, the new quiet war machine stood, so to speak, in the sparkling gold-plated hardware on a showroom floor. By 1954, with the creation of the master in 1954, the promise of unlocking UN unlimited sources of fusion or atomic energy from heavy hydrogen in seawater and consequently availability of unlimited social power was a possibility only decades away. The combination was irresistible. The quiet war was quietly declared by international elite, the Bilderberg Group, at a meeting held in 1954. Although the silent weapons system was nearly exposed 13 years later, the evolution of the new weapons system had never suffered any major setbacks. This volume marks the 25th anniversary of the beginning of the Quiet War. Already, this domestic war has had many victories on many fronts throughout the world. Political introduction. In 1954, it was well recognized by those in position of authority that it was only a matter of time, only a few decades, before a general public would be able to grasp the upset, the cradle of power for the very elements of the new silent weapon technology, whereas accessible for a public utopia as they were for providing a private utopia. The issue of primary concern, that of dominance, resolved around the subject of the energy of science. Energy recognized as the key to all activity on Earth. I'm not going to read all this. I just wanted you guys to hear that, those parts, but I'm going to go a little further. Energy is recognized as the key to all activity on Earth. Natural science is the study of the sources and control of natural energy, and social science, theoretically expressed as economics, is the study of sources and control of social energy. Both are bookkeeping systems. Mathematics, therefore, mathematics is the primary energy science, and the bookkeeper can be king if the public can be kept ignorant of the mythology of the bookkeeping. All science is All science is merely a means to an end. The means is knowledge. The end is control. The ends always justify the means. Beyond this remains only one issue, who will be the beneficiary. In 1954, this was the issue of primary concern. Although the so-called moral issues were raised in view of the law of natural selection, it was agreed that the nation or world of people who will not use the intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent. Consequently, in the interest of future world order, peace, and tranquility, it was decided to probably wage quiet war against the American public with an ultimate objective of permanently shifting the natural and social energy, wealth, and undisciplined and irresponsible into the hands of the self-disciplined, responsible, and worthy few. In order to implement this objective, it was necessary to create, secure, and apply new weapons, which, as it turned out, were a class of weapons so subtle and sophisticated in their principle of operation and public appearance as to earn for themselves the name silent weapons. In conclusion, the objective of economic research as conducted by the magnates of capital banking and the industries of commodities, goods, and services is the establishment of an economy which is totally predictable and manipulable. In order to achieve a total predictable economy, the low-class elements of society must be brought under total control, i.e. must be housebroken, trained, and assigned a yoke and long-term social duties from a very early age before they have an opportunity to question the propriety of the matter. In order to achieve such conformity, the lower-class family union must be disintegrated by a process of increasing preoccupation of the parents and the establishment of government-operated daycare centers for the occupationally orphaned children. The quality of education given to these lower classes must be of the poorest sort, so that the moat of ignorance isolating the inferior class from the superior class is and remains incomprehensible to the inferior class. With such an initial handicap, even bright lower class individuals have little, if any, hope of extricating themselves from their assigned lot in life. This form of slavery is essential to maintaining some measure of social order, peace, and tranquility for the ruling upper class. Descriptive introduction of the silent weapon. Everything that is expected from an ordinary weapon is expected from a silent weapon by its creators, but only in its own manner of junctioning. It shoots situations instead of bullets, propelled by data processing instead of chemical reaction, explosion, originating from bits of data instead of grains of gunpowder, from a computer instead of a gun, operated by a computer programmer instead of a marksman, under the orders of banking magnate instead of a military general. It makes no obvious explosive noises, causes no obvious physical or mental injuries, and does not obviously interfere with anyone's daily life. Yet it makes an unmistakable noise, causes unmistakable physical and mental damage, and unmistakably interferes with daily social life, i.e. unmistakable to a trained observer. One who knows what to look for. The public cannot comprehend this weapon and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong. Isn't that the truth? But because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express that they're feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it. When a silent weapon is applied gradually, the public just adapts to its presence and learns to tolerate the encroachment on their lives until the pressure, psychological via economic, becomes too great and they crack up. Therefore, the silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobility of individuals of society by knowingly understanding, manipulating, and attacking their sources of natural social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses.
Brother Braggs, hey, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes, we need to take our station identification break. You're listening to Tando Radio Show right here on the Black Talk Radio Network. We'll be right back with more from Brother Braggs on the other side.
Okay.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses. And welcome back to Tando Radio Show. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 866-510-9025. Hit ** on your telephone keypad to unmute. Brother Braggs.
Hey, Scotty, can you hear me, man?
Yes, sir.
Okay, have I been coming through clear? That's what I was wondering.
Yes.
Okay. All right, I'm just going to read a couple more pages from Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, The Whole of Pale Horse, William Cooper, and then I'm going to jump to this other one because I really want to get into this conspiracy thing I got here. I think that's very interesting. Okay, so where we are now, theoretical introduction, give me control over our nation's currency. And I care not who makes this law. This is Meyer Amschai Rothschild, 1743 to 1812. Today's silent weapons technology is an outgrowth of a simple idea discovered, succinctly expressed, and effectively applied by the quote of Mr. Amschai Rothschild. Mr. Rothschild discovered the missing passive component of an economic theory known as economic inductance. He, of course, did not take of his discovery in the 20th century terms, and to be sure, mathematical analysts had to wait for the second industrial revolution, the rise of the theory of mechanics and electronics, and finally the invention of the electronic computer before it could be effectively applied in the control of the world economy. General energy concepts. In the study of energy systems, there will always appear three elementary concepts. These are potential energy, kinetic energy, and energy dissipation. And corresponding to these concepts are three idealized, essentially pure physical counterparts called passive components. In the science of physical mechanics, the phenomenon of a potential energy is associated with a physical property called elasticity. That's the word. Sorry about that. I can't say it. Okay. Now I'm messed up. I'm laughing at myself. Okay. Where was I? Okay. In the study of energy systems, there always appears elementary concepts. There are potential energy, okay, in the science of the physical mechanics, the phenomenon of potential energy associated with the physical property called elasticity or stiffness. It can be represented by a stretch spring. In electronic science, potential energy is stored in a capacitor instead of a spring. This property is called a capacitor instead of elasticity or stiffness. In the science of physical mechanics, the phenomenon of kinetic energy is associated with a physical property called inertia or mass. It can be represented by a mass or a flywheel in motion. In electronic science, kinetic energy is stored in an inducer, in a magnetic field In electronic science, kinetic energy is stored in an inductor, in a magnetic field, instead of a mass. This property is called inductance instead of inertia. In the science of physical mechanics, the phenomenon of energy dissipation is associated with a physical property called friction or resistance and can be represented by a dash point or other device which converts systems into energy, into heat. In electronic science, dissipation of energy is performed by an element called either a resistor or a conductor, the term resistor being the one generally used to express the concept of friction and the term conductor being generally used to describe a more ideal device, e.g. wire, employed to convey electronic energy efficiently from one location to the other. The property of resistance or conductor is measured as either resistance or conductance reciprocals. In economics, these three energy concepts are associated with economic capacitance, capital, money, stock, inventory, investment in buildings and durables, economic conductance, goods production flow coefficient, and three is economic inductance, services, the influence of population or industry or output. All of the mathematical theory developed in the study of one energy system, e.g. math, mechanics, electronics, etc., can be immediately applied in the study of any energy system. Mr. Rothschild's energy discovery. What Mr. Rothschild had discovered was the basic principle of power and influence and control over people as applied to economics. The principle is when you assume the appearance of power, people will soon give it to you. Mr. Rothschild had discovered that currency or deposit loan accounts had the required appearance of power that could be used to induce people inductance with people corresponding to a magnetic field into surrendering their real wealth in exchange for a promise of greater wealth instead of real compensation. They would put up real collateral in exchange for a loan of promissory notes. Mr. Rothschild found that he could issue more notes than he had backing for, so long as he had someone stock of gold as a precursor to show his customers. Mr. Rothschild loaned his promissory notes to individuals and to governments. These would create overconfidence. Then he would make money scarce, tighten control of the system, and collect the collateral through the obligation of contracts. The cycle was then repeated. These pressures could be used to ignite a war. Then he would control the availability of currency to determine who would win the war. That government, which agreed to give him control of his economic system, got his support. Collection of debts was guaranteed by economic aid to the enemy of the debtor. Collection of debts was guaranteed by economic aid to the enemy of the debtor. The profit derived from this economic mythology made Mr. Rothschild all the more able to extend his wealth. He found that the public greed would allow currency to be printed by government order beyond the limits. Inflation of backing in precious metal or the production of goods and services, gross national product. Apparent capitalist paper inductor. In this structure, credit presented as a pure element called currency has the appearance of capital, but is in fact a negative capital. Hence, it has the appearance of service, but in fact, indebtedness or debt. It is therefore an economic inductance instead of an economic capacitance. And if balanced in no other way, will be balanced by the negation of population, war, genocide. The total goods and services represent the real capital called the gross national product. And the currency may be printed up to this level and still represent economic capacitance. But currency printed beyond this level is subtractive, represents the introduction of economic inductance, and constitutes notes of indebtedness. War is therefore the balancing of the system by killing the true creditors, the public which we have taught to exchange true value for inflated currency, and falling back on whatever is left of the resources of nature and the regeneration of those resources. Mr. Rothschild had discovered that currency gave him the power to rearrange the economic structure to his own advantage, to shift economic inductance to the economic positions which would encourage the greatest economic instability and oscillation. The final key to economic control had to wait until there was sufficient data and high-speed computing equipment to keep close watch on the economic oscillations created by price shocking and yet excess paper energy, credits, paper inductance, inflation. Breakthrough. The aviation field provided the greatest evolution in economic engineering by way of mathematical theory of shock testing. In this project, a projectile is fired from an airframe on the ground, and the impulse of the recoil is monitored by vibration transducers connected to the airframe and wired to chart recorders. By studying the echoes or reflections of the recoil impulse in the airframe, it is possible to discover critical vibrations in the structure of the airframe, which either vibrations of the engines or alien vibrations of the wings or a combination of the two might reinforce, resulting in resonant self-destruction of the airframe in flight as an aircraft. From the standpoint of engineering, this means that the strength and weaknesses of the structure of the airframe in terms of vibrational energy can be discovered and manipulated. This will be the last two pages of this one. Application in economics. To use this method of airframe shock testing and economic engineering, the prices of commodities are shocked and a public consumer reaction is monitored. The resulting echoes of economic shock are interpreted theoretically by computers and psychoeconomic structure of economy is thus discovered. It is by this process that partial differentiation and differences, matrices, are discovered that define the family household and make possible its evaluation as an economic industry, dissipative consumer structure. Then the response of the household to future shocks can be predicted and manipulated. and society becomes a well-regulated animal with its reins under the control of a sophisticated computer-regulated social energy bookkeeping system. Eventually, every individual element of the structure comes under computer control through a knowledge of personal preference. Such knowledge guaranteed by computer association of consumer preferences, universal product code, UPC, zebra stripe, price codes, or packages, with identified consumers identified via association with the use of a credit card and later a permanent tattooed body number, invisible in the normal ambient illumination. The economic model. The Harvard Economic Research Project 1948 was an extension of World War II operations research. Its purpose was to discover the science of controlling an economy. As the first American economy, and then the world economy, it was felt that with sufficient mathematical foundation and data, it would be nearly as easy to predict and control the trend of an economy as to predict and control the trajectory of a projectile. Such has proven to be the case. Moreover, the economy has been transformed into a guided missile on target. The immediate aim of the Harvard Project was to discover the economic structure, what forces change that structure, how the behavior of that structure can be predicted, and how it can be manipulated. What was needed was a well-organized knowledge of mathematical structures and interrelationships of investment, production, distribution, and consumption. To make a short story of it all, it was discovered that an economy obeyed the same laws as electricity, and that all mathematical theory and practical and computer know-how developed for the electric field could be directly applied in the study of economics. This discovery was not openly declared, and in the study of economics, discovery was closely guarded secret. For example, that in the economic model, human life is measured in dollars, and that in the electric spark generated when opening a switch connected to an active inductor is mathematically analogous. That's the word, analogous to the initiation of war. So a spark will start a war, just a spark. The greatest hurdle which theoretical economists faced was the accurate description of the household as an industry. This is the challenge because consumer purchases are a matter of choice, when in turn is influenced by income, price, and other economic factors. This hurdle was created in an indirect and statistically appropriate way by application of shock testing to determine the current characteristics called current technical coefficients, a household industry. Finally, because problems in theoretical economics can be translated very easily into problems in theoretical electronics and a solution transferred back again, it follows that only a book of language translation and concept definition needed to be written for economics. The remainder could be gotten from standard works on mathematics and electronics. This makes the publication of books on advanced economics unnecessary and greatly simplifies project security. Industrial diagrams. An ideal industry is defined as a device which receives value from other industries in several forms and converts it into one specific product for sales and distribution to other industries. It has several inputs and one output. What the public normally thinks is one industry is really an industrial complex where several industries under one roof produce one or more products. The industrial classes. Class one, capital resources. Class two, commodities or use, dissipated. Class three, services, action of population. Class one, industries exist as three levels, nature, sources of energy and raw materials, government, printing of currency equal to gross national product. GNP, extension, inflation, currency in excess of GPN, banking, loaning of money of interest and extension, inflation, counterfeiting of economic value through deposit loan accounts. Class two, industries exist as producers of tangible or consumer dissipated products. This sort of activity is usually recognized and labeled by the public as an industry. Class three industries are those which have services rather than a tangible product as their output. These industries are called households. And two, governments. Their output is human activity on a mechanical sort, and their basis is population. Aggregation. A whole economic system can be represented by a three-industry model if one allows the names of the outputs to be capital, goods, and services. The problem with this representation is that it would now show the influence of, say, the textile industry on the ferrous metal industry. This is because both the textile industry and the ferrous metal industry would be contained within a single classification called the goods industry. And by this process of combining or aggregating these two industries under one system block, they would lose their economic individuality. All right, that's far as I'm going in here. Now, I'm going to jump all the way out of here, and I'm jumping right now into Conspiracies and Secret Societies and Complete Dossier by Brad Steiger and Sherry Steiger. I found this to be very interesting. And I'm just reading the stuff that I, you know, to you guys that I usually read when I'm doing what I do. I found this very interesting. This is about the Bush family. Is that the one I wanted to read first? Oh, no. Bear with me for 1 second while I gather myself here. Oh, yeah, I'm going to run a few of them at you, though. But we'll start off with this one to just take longer. This is about, this is George H.W. Bush. The Bush family tree reveals this descent from a revealed traitor and a ruthless warlord who took delight in invading other countries, which is stronger, heredity or environment, or does it matter? According to an Irish artist working on a tapestry to commemorate Ireland's Norman heritage, the Bush family is descended from a line of traitors and ruthless warlords. Anne Griffin Bernstorff was researching the history of Richard B. Clare, Earl of Pembroke, and she discovered the genealogical link to George H.W. Bush family in the United States. Pembroke, known as Strongbow for his skill as an archer, was a power-hungry warlord who led an invasion of Old Ireland. The Bush lineage can also be traced to Dermot McMurrow. I wonder if I'm saying that right. Okay, McMurrow, who is revealed in Irish history books as Ireland's worst traitor for collaborating with the Normans. McMurrow was said to be so vicious a warrior that he severed the heads of his victims and tore at the flesh of particularly hated victims with his teeth. When President George H.W. Bush, having led the United States in the Persian War, Gulf War, and his son, President George H. Bush, declaring war on Iraq in search of non-existent weapons and mass destruction, many U.S. citizens are left to ponder how much of that ruthless warlord blood surges through the veins of the Bush dynasty. Behavioralists and social psychologists have been debated for decades about whether it is in our genetics or the environment in which we are reared that has more influence on our character and who we really are. Perhaps it is equal parts of both that shape our destiny. Hey, look, this might sound a little boring, but it's going to get better. Just bear with me. George H. Bush's maternal grandfather, George Herbert Burt Walker, moved to his St. Louis banking and investment firm to the prestigious address of 1 Wall Street in the early 1920s, and was one of Adolf Hitler's most powerful financial supporters. Burt Walker's sponsorship of the Nazis went back to 1924 when Fritz Thyssen, the wealthy German industrialist, was financing the fledgling Nazi party. Everell Harriman, W.A. Harriman and company sold more than $50 million of German bonds to American investors and Walker's Union Banking, located in the offices of Harriman's firm, became a virtual Nazi money laundering machine. In 1934, Bert Walker arranged to have his son-in-law, Prescott Bush, placed on the board of directors of Union Banking. About the same time, Walker took over the North American office of the Hamburg America Line, which was smuggling German agents into the U.S. to bribe politicians to see things Hitler's way. Just before the Nazi invasion of Poland in September 1939, ignited World War II, Prescott Bush's investment firm arranged for Hitler's Luftwaffe to obtain Tektro lead for its airplanes as gas. A great source of revenue for Bush was terminated in 1942 when three firms with which he was associated were seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act. All of the shares of Union Banking were seized and major sections of other companies were confiscated. When it was determined they were being operated on behalf of Nazi Germany, one of Bert Walker's employees had been a double agent for naval intelligence and had blown the whistle on the shipping company's deals with the Nazis. William S. Flash, one of Prescott Bush's partners in business deals with Hitler, was grilled so intently by the Senate about his Nazi dealings that he collapsed and died on November 29, 1492. seeing clearly the ominous handwriting, the ominous handwriting on the wall. 18-year-old George H.W. Bush gave up his plans to enter Yale and enter the flight school in October 1942, perhaps in an effort to salvage the family honors, for he was quite aware that his father was under investigation for running Nazi front groups in the United States. George H.W. Bush returned from World War II, a hero awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, the youngest pilot in the Navy, who endured great years bailing out of his torpedo bomb over the Pacific when it was hit by Japanese aircraft fire. Years later, Chester Zerbjewski, a turret gunner on bomber flying near Bush's plane, claimed to have an unobscured view of the incident and stated that Bush's aircraft was never on fire and that the Bush never attempted a water landing, which was standard procedure and which would have given his crew, Jack Delaney and Ted White, a chance to survive. After the war, Bush entered Yale and in 1948 became a member of Skull and Bones. By 1955, he had formed Zapata Oil with the Dickey brothers, Hugh and Bill, then brought them out to set up Pimago, a Mexican drilling operation, through a front man to hide his ownership. Unfortunately for Bush's go-between, he was convicted of defrauding the Mexican government and fined $58 million. Some investigators are convinced that George Bush spent part of 1960 and 61 in Miami organizing anti-Castro Cubans on behalf of the CIA. CIA official Fletcher Prouty has said that he delivered three Navy ships for use in the Bay of Pigs invasion to a CIA agent named George Bush, who subsequently named the vessels the Barbara, the Houston, and the Zapata. The ill-fated Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba became a black eye for the Kennedy administration, with 115 men lost and another 1,100 imprisoned. Many researchers placed George Bush in Texas when John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22, 1963. An article in The Nation, 1988, quoted a member from J. Edgar Hoover, the late former FBI chief, stating that Mr. George Bush of the CIA was briefed on November 23rd about the reaction of anti-Castro Cubans to news of assassination. Bush admitted that he was in Texas at the time, but said that he couldn't recall exactly where, and he stated firmly that Hoover must have been referring to another George Bush. George H.W. Bush entered politics in 1964, running for Congress as a Goldwater Republican, campaigning against Civil Rights Act. He served two terms as representative from Texas and ran twice, unsuccessful for the Senate. In 1971, President Reagan named him ambassador to the United States. In 1973, Bush was named the Republican Party National Chair, and he brought into the GOP the Heritage Group, a council, a group with a number of Nazi sympathizers. After serving as chief of the U.S. liaison office in the People's Republic of China, Bush was named director of the CIA by President Gerald Ford in 1976. Bush claimed that this was the first time that he had worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, and once again, now that he was George Bush associated with either the Bay of Pigs disaster or the JFK investigation. While serving as CIA chief, Bush provided special training for Saudi royal family palace guards. Bush met with Manuel Noriega and guaranteed him a stipend of $100,000 a year, even though the Panamanian dictator was known to be working for Fidel Castro as well. It was at this time that Bush established Team B within the CIA, a group of neoconservative special agents and generals. In 1978, Bush, Robert Mosbacher, and Jim Banker became partners in an oil firm, Arbusto Energy. In 1980, Bush was named Ronald Reagan's vice presidential candidate. Mosbacher, as chief fundraiser for Bush, developed a millionaires club of 250 contributors, each of whom was assessed $100,000 for membership fees. In 1981, the Bush-Reagan team was inaugurated. Some investigators state that after Bush became vice president and drug czar, cocaine flow in the United States increased by over 2,000% due to the militarization of phony drug war. The researchers claim Bush declared war on American people and the Bill of Rights. In 1988, Bush campaigned for the president and assigned Stuart Spencer to improve the image of his running mate. Dan Quayle, who always seemed to be suffering from foot and mouth disease, a drug dealer who claimed to have sold marijuana to Quayle, was put in solitary confinement by the head of the federal prison. In the midst of a heated presidential campaign, Bush had to contend with the uncomfortable circumstances of his son Neil getting caught up in the savings and loan scandal. Neil Silverado's savings and loan endeavor was shut down after receiving 126 cease and desist orders and 4 years at a taxpayer cost of $1 billion. political pressure was placed on Bush to disassociate himself from GOP Coalition of America after many of the leaders were accused of anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial. Fred Malik, a former Nixon aide, was asked to leave the presidential campaign when it was revealed that he was compiling a list of Jews in the Labor Department investigating a possible Jewish cabal on orders from former President Nixon. The offensive Willie Norton political ad was telecast suggesting that Bush's opponent, Michael Dukakis, would be soft on rapists, drug pushers, and child molesters. In 1989, Bush was inaugurated as the 41st president of the United States. He denied knowing Manuel Noriega was a drug dealer and authorized CIA support to the dictator's opposition, thereby providing Noriega with an opportunity to annul Panama's elections. In Operation Just Cause, Bush sent troops to Panama with orders to overthrow the corrupt regime. Noriega was brought back to the United States to stand trial as a drug trafficker. He was imprisoned in 1992 and remained in a federal prison in Miami until he suffered a minor stroke in December 2004 and was moved to an undisclosed hospital. Bush also claimed executive privilege to escape the testifying in the Oliver North trial, thereby becoming the first U.S. president to seal his former activities as a vice president. William Casey, CIA director during the Reagan-Bush administration, died 2 days before he was to testify. Banker Edmund J. Sanford, whose bank had been used for laundering money for the Iran-Contra affair, died mysteriously when a fire swept through his Monaco penthouse apartment. George Bush signed the savings and loan bailout bill in 1990. Federal regulators gave Neil Bush a seemingly impossible mild penalty over the fact that he, Silverado's director, voted to approve over $100 million in loans to his partners. Neil soon formed Apex Energy with a personal investment of $3,000, receiving $2.7 million from a small business loan program. Apex failed and Neil ducked out after receiving $320,000 salary. The entire savings and loan industry was said to be losing investors money at a rate of $3 million a minute. Estimates for the total cost of federal bailout exceeded $500 billion. Bush's son Jeb convinced the federal government to pay off the $4 million he owed to a federal fraud and thrift. George's brother Jonathan, brokerage firm, was fined in 2 states for violations in Barton, Massachusetts. In August 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and Bush was determined to turn the dictator of Iraq away from the oil fields and keep him from obtaining even stronger control of the world oil markets. Osama bin Laden urged the Saudi royal family to fight Hussein on their own and to raise the mighty Arab army. Already uncertain of bin Laden's motives, the Saudi royals requested that the United States assume the task of driving Hussein's meaning man army back to Iraq. Bush received UN approval to free Kuwait, and 420,000 American troops were joined by 118,000 soldiers from allied nations. After several weeks of air missile strikes, the 100-hour land battle called Desert Storm turned Hussein's army conquest of Kuwait to a rapid defeat. Conspiracy theorists believe that Bush and the leaders of Kuwait tricked former ally Hussein into attacking Kuwait so Bush could declare war under a UN mandate to strengthen the UN and hike up petroleum prices in order to protect his own oil investments. In 1992, George W. Bush lost his run for another term in the White House to Bill Clinton. After a time, Bush became an advisor to the powerful Washington-based investment firm as a Carlyle Group. Among his duties, Bush set about strengthening Carlyle's defense ties to the Saudi royal family. Bush visited the Bin Laden family compound and solicited their investment in the Carlyle Group. In 1993, first attack on the World Trade Center in New York occurred. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have been linked to the initial bombing of the World Trade Center, as well as to the destruction of the World Trade Center and the attack on the Pentagon on September 11, 2001.
Brother Braggs
was accusing the George W. Bush administration of having known in advance that the September 11 attacks would occur. It only throws fuel on the fire to learn that the World Trade Center was collapsing and thousands of lives were being lost. The news interrupted a Carlyle business meeting that was being held at the Ritz-Carlton in New York. Attending the conference was former President George H.W. Bush and brother of Osama bin Laden, a fellow Carlyle investor. Neither claimed to have any advance information about the attacks on the World Trade Center. All right, I'm going to flip over.
Brother Braggs, if you can hear me. Can you hear me, Brother Braggs? Brother Braggs. Brother Braggs.
Yes, sir.
Yes, we're going to take our last break of the evening. Before we do so, I just want to remind you we do have more live programming tonight on the network coming up at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. Will be Race Treaty, where they will be speaking about international law and human rights. I believe the guests will be from the Malcolm X grassroots movement. So, again, that's Race Treaty tonight at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern time on Black Talk Radio Network. You're listening to Tando Radio Show with Brother Braggs sharing information with us. We'll be back on the other side. Black Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium. Tuned in to Black Talk Radio, new black media for the new millennium. We're back, Brother Braggs.
All righty. Hey, I'm jumping back into Behold a Pale Horse, and I'm in FEMA chapter now. That's chapter 6, H.R. 4079 in FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency. I'm just going to read you a few things from this. I find this stuff to be fascinating. The following is a transcript. And the beginning of the tape, there's a guy by the name of Buster Heron. He's a member of FEMA, and he's a member of the Interdepartment Unit, which is empowered in the event of national security emergency to become the unelected national government, a sort of FEMA secret government, so to speak. A pretext for invoking those emergency measures can be found almost daily in the newspapers. It can be anything from suspension of debt payments by the high bureaus of the American country to mass runs on U.S. commercial banks. And that's an issue, by the way, that's being handled personally by the National Security Council and Brent Sofcroft. The food shortage, to the drug war, the whole bit, anything, any disaster, emergency declared at all, even including the oil spill from the Exxon tanker in Alaska. If the president had declared a national emergency, that could have triggered it. Any instability in the Middle East, anything in fact, and they already tested for capabilities in April 1984 with Rex 84A. Yeah. Pull that Rex 84A when you can. That's a serious one right there. And what goes with Rex 84 is the King Alpha plan. Pull that King Alpha plan and read that bad boy all the way through. It's going to shake you to your boots. But back to what's at hand. Yeah, King Alpha plan and Rex 84. If you Google them, wherever you can find them, pull them up, read them. Okay. A pretext for invoking those emergency measures can be found almost daily in the newspapers. It can be anything from suspension of debt payments to high bureaus in American countries to mass runs on U.S. commercial banks. All right, I read all that. Okay. Now, the executive order that will implement this, the executive order is 11051, details responsibility of the Office of Emergency Planning, or FEMA. It gives authorization to put all executive orders into effect in times of national emergency declared by the president, increased international tension, or economic or financial crisis. Note that it covers every conceivable domestic crisis, but does not even mention war or nuclear attack. Notice that. That's deep. Now, the only thing that has to happen to, for FEMA to be able to implement all the executive orders, emergency executive orders, is for the president to declare a national emergency of any type, as long as it's a national emergency. Executive Order 10995 provides for takeover of communication media. Executive Order 10997 provides for the takeover of all electric power, petroleum, gas, fuels, and minerals. And this has been updated. This is the old version. It's an updated version of this, too, because it was updated by President Obama. All they do is reinforce one another. Executive Order 10988 provides for the takeover of food resources and farm. Executive Order 10999 provides for the takeover of all modes of transportation, control of highways, seaports, etc. Executive Order 1100 provides for mobilization of all civilians into work brigades under government supervision. Executive Order 11001 provides for governmental takeover of all health, educational, and welfare functions. Executive Order 1102 designates the Postmaster General to operate a national registration of all persons. Executive Order 11003 provides for the government to take over airports and aircraft. Executive Order 11004 provides for housing and financial authority to relocate communities, designate areas to be abandoned, and establish new locations for populations. Executive Order 11005 provides for government to take over railroads, inland waterways, and public storage facilities. Now, all of these were combined under Nixon into one huge executive order, which allows all of this to take place if the president declares a national emergency, and it can be implemented by the head of FEMA, not by the president. The president has already given him the power under these executive orders. All of these were combined into Executive Order 11490 that was signed by President Carter on July 20, 1979, and is, in fact, law. And so H.R. 407 is passed, and the president does what it says and declares a national emergency because of drug situation, whether it's for 1 year, 5 years, 5 minutes, or forever. It doesn't make any difference. FEMA then implement all executive orders, take over all local, state, and national governments, suspend the Constitution, and do whatever they want to. Now, remember, what North said during the Iran-Contra hearing. He said they were prepared to suspend the Constitution of the United States. And he said if it hadn't been for their getting caught, that this would have happened. And all that did was delay it. This is what is still going today. This is what is still going to happen. Now they are nominated, and I think he's appointed Major General Calvin Franklin, who's the head of FEMA. This is a little old, too, so all this has been updated. But I'm just reading you these orders because they're still pertinent. They're still law today. Discussing proposing the removal of information of National Guard in Washington, D.C., and Major General Franklin is or was the commanding general of the District of Columbia National Guard. Now, you've got to know that the National Guard would be of no help at all in combating drug trafficking in Washington, D.C., or anywhere else. The primary effectiveness of the National Guard is controlling mass civil disorders. On March 24th, President Bush issued a new executive order delegating to the director of FEMA powers which were vested in the president by the Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act of 1988. And although the order is described by the White House as simply a technical matter, in reality, the revision delegates to FEMA, to the FEMA director, direct responsibility for a large number of items which were earlier only the president's prerogative. And that includes responsibility for general federal assistance, federal emergency assistance, hazard mitigation, individual and family grant programs, and the power to direct other federal agencies to assist in the emergency. And that's the key. All other federal agencies will come under FEMA. Of course, the president retains the power to actually declare an emergency, but as soon as he does that, the implementation of the measures utilized will be transferred directly to the director of FEMA, the brains behind the contingency plan for a police state, or the members of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, both of which Bush is a member, and Brent Sokoff, National Security Advisor, who was a member of FEMA's advisory board until he was appointed by Bush to head the National Security Council as a member of the Trilateral Commission, and also a business partner to Henry Kissinger, who has been a traitor to this country for many years. And of course, Sokoff will become the superior to FEMA in the chain of command of the national security emergency whenever it is declared. The FEMA advisory board is dominated by Professor Samuel P. Huntington. In 1978, Huntington drafted what Jimmy Carter, Presidential Memorandum 32, which led to the creation of FEMA in 1979, and he's a Harvard professor. He wrote the seminal piece for the Trilateral Commission in the mid-1970s, recommending that democracy and economic development be discarded as outdated ideas. He wrote his co-author of the book, Cries in Democracy. We have come to recognize that there are potential desirable limits to economic growth, that there are also potentially desirable limits to the indefinite extension of political democracy. A government which lacks authority will have little ability, short of cataclysmic crisis, to impose on its people the sacrifices which may be necessary. All of Huntington's ideas were rewritten into National Security Decision Directive 47, which is NSDD 47, and was enacted by President Reagan on July 22, 1982. It identified important areas to be upgraded, such as the nation's industrial base to maintain a national defense. But nonetheless, and this is very important, laid the groundwork for the secret government's operations to institute a police state, and its title is Emergency Mobilization Preparedness. It ordered preparedness measures that involved the weaving or modification in socioeconomic regulations that delay emergency responses and that should receive priority attention. It also specified the preparedness measures that are or may be impeded by legal constraints be identified in the priority task that lays the groundwork for the suspension of the Constitution. Make copies of this tape if you want to. You don't even have to transcribe it if you don't want to. But get this out to the people. It's important that they understand that H.R. 4070 is past. Their history. They won't pass if we get this out to the people and people then and tell them that this is what they're doing. Most people don't even know about it, and that's the secret government benefit. If we get out and tell the people what they're doing, then people can get on the phone and go down and kick their congressman's ass, which is what they should have been doing years ago, and get this thing thrown out of Congress. And the next thing they need to do is throw their congressmen and their senators out of Congress and keep them out of Congress and put their neighbors in there, people that they can trust, and keep them in there for only one term. The Constitution is in serious danger. This has nothing to do with the right wing, left wing, or any other damn thing. It has to do with the Illuminati taking over the country and joining in the New World Order. When you give this out to people, make sure they agree to make 10 copies and send it to all their friends. That's the end. That was a tape. That was the end of the tape. I'll hit you with one more quick thing. I'm going back into Conspiracy and Secret Society, The Complete Dossier by Brad Stiegler and Sherry Stiegler for educational purposes only. Fair use. It's my book. Okay. This is some stuff that I find really interesting. These are just, for instance, Al Qaeda. They always mention Al Qaeda in the news, but if you go back and check Al Qaeda issued a statement in 1998 that is their duty as holy warriors to kill all U.S. citizens. Al Qaeda, sometimes spelled Al Qaeda, Arabic for the base, is a terrorist group founded by Osama bin Laden in the late 1980s. To unite Arabs who fought against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Bin Laden, son of a billionaire Saudi family, is reported to have inherited approximately $300 million that he uses to finance the terrorist group. Al Qaeda may have several hundred to several thousand members in a loosely organized network of cells throughout the world. The terrorist group also serves as a kind of conduit for a worldwide network that includes many Sunni Islamic extremist groups such as Egyptian Islamic Jihad, Al-Gamas, Al-Islamiyya, and the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, and the Harakat Mujahideen. Al-Qaeda also maintains money-making front organizations, solicits donations from like-minded supporters, and initially siphons funds from donations to legitimate Muslim charities. Although the Al-Qaeda was organized by Osama bin Laden, he is not its only leader. Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, an Egyptian surgeon from an upper-class family, is the group's theological leader and bin Laden's most likely successor. Conspiracy theorists fear that the great terrorist acts of our time were openly planned in radical mosques in Hamburg, London, and Paris, offering Muslims the opportunity to become Mujahideen, holy warriors, in a jihad holy war in which they may achieve holy martyrdom. According to many conspiracy researchers, the shadowy figures of the New World Order and a number of secret societies are behind it all, fanning the flames of planetary conflagration. in February 1998, Al-Qaeda issued a statement titled The World Islamic Front for Jihad and the Jews and Crusaders, declaring that it was the duty of all Muslims to kill U.S. citizens, civilian or military, and their allies elsewhere. Some of the terror acts of death and destruction sown by Al-Qaeda are the following. 1992, conducted 3 bombings that hit U.S. troops in Allen Union. 1993, Al-Qaeda trained Somalian tribesmen, conducted ambushes of U.S. peacekeeping forces in Somalia, downed 2 helicopters in Mogadishu, and killed 15 U.S. armed rangers. 1994, plotted to blow up the Israel embassy in Washington, planned to assassinate Pope John Paul II in Manila, attempted to arrange the simultaneous bombings of U.S. and Israeli embassies in Manila and other Asian capitals. 1995, planned to assassinate President Bill Clinton when he visited the Philippines, bombed a military complex in Rahaya, Saudi Arabia, housing U.S. troops, killing 5 Americans and wounding 42. 1996, Trump bombed a U.S. military complex near Dahran, Saudi Arabia, killing 19 U.S. airmen and wounding 515 people, including 240 civilians, Americans. 1998, bombed U.S. embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, killing at least 301 persons, injuring more than 5,000 others. Attempted to bomb a U.S. embassy in Kampala, Uganda, 2000, bombed the U.S. coal while the ship was in port in Union. Now that's wrong. Killing 17 in India. They found out that wasn't them who did that. I remember that one. That was done by their allies. 2001, crash hijacked airliners into World Trade Center and Pentagon killing. Okay. And I want y'all to hear this too. The American Family Association. These are just groups in America. The American Family Association condones television as being a trash land as well as a vast wasteland. Founded in 1977 by Reverend Donald Wilmore as the National Federation of Decency, the organization was renamed the American Family Association. In 1998, Whitman, a former Methodist minister, has become well known as an effective force in moving advertising on television that has deemed trash and objectionable. Appointed to Attorney General Edward Meese's commission on the pornography during the Reagan administration by the commission's executive director, Alan Shears, Whitman in 1985 managed to persuade 17,000 convenience stores to remove such magazines as Playboy and Penthouse from their shelves. In 2005, Donald Wildman's son, assumed the ARF presidency and overseer of 200 station radio network, a monthly journal distributed to nearly 200,000 subscribers and about 100 employees. This is the one that got me, American Nazi Party. George Lincoln Rockwell decided that he couldn't be president of the United States, he would still have people saluting as founder of the American Nazi Party. The American Nazi Party was founded in February 1959 in the residence of George Lincoln Rockwell in Arlington, Virginia, rather than gathering in a crowd meeting hall with hundreds of men wearing swastikas, armed men, shooting their new leader. With a chorus of Sarah Hillis, 6 people gathered in Rockwell's living room voted to call their group the World Union Free Enterprise National Socialists. Later, they would change their name to American Nazi Party. And when Rockwell began his candidacy for the president of the United States, the George Lincoln Party, Rockwell wanted to be president, but he told his followers that first, in 1965, he would gain the governorship of Virginia. In another 6 years, in 1972, he would be elected president. Rockwell's party platform was easy to find: confiscate all property owned by Jews, sterilize all Jews, exterminate all Jews who are guilty of resistance or treason, deport all Americans, African Americans to Africa, amend the U.S. Constitution, comply with the Governing Council to the Third Reich. Rockwell was fined in prison several times. On August 25th, he was shot dead and killed as he pulled out of a parking space in Arlington Center, shopping center. The assassin fired from the rooftop of a beauty salon across the street was a captain in the American Nazi Party, John Prattler. 29 December 1970, Prattler was sentenced to 20 years in prison for Rockwell's murder. I just want to run up a couple of these, the other ones I find interesting. Oh, the Army of God, I find this really interesting. The Army of God, the battle cry of the Army of God, death to the New World Order, has become a death sentence for abortion clinics and their staffs. The Army of God is an extreme religious group that was organized around 1962 and has declared its objective to be the waging of a total war on an ungodly communist regime in New York and the legislative bureaucracy lackeys in Washington with the battle cry, death to the New World Order. The Army of God targets homosexuals, abortion clinics, and all those who preside over the death of children and to issue policies of ungodly perversions that are destroying the American people. In the early 1980s, while the women's clinic in Granite City, Illinois, was being mobbed by fundamentalist protesters, Dr. Hester Gavalos, the clinic operator, and his wife, Rosalie, were kidnapped by members of the Army of God. After being held for 8 days in an abandoned ammunition bunker, the captives were released when Gavalos gave his pledge that he would perform no more abortions. Gunn, Benny Anderson, two other members of the Army of God, Matthew and Wade, were later convicted of the kidnapping. Anderson's explaining that God had told him to wage war against abortion. Sinners did nothing to convince the judge to cut him any slack, and he received a 30-year prison term for kidnapping. In addition to 30 years, we learned that he had torched two foreign abortion clinics. And the next one is the Aryan Nations have issued a declaration of independence from the United States and declared Anglo-Saxons as two chosen people. Aryan Nations is a paramilitary group that was founded in the mid-1970s by Reverend Richard Graham Butler and structured around his Church of Jesus Christ Christians, one of the numerous churches associated with the Christian identity movement. Originally headquartered near Hayden Lake, Idaho, the international headquarters of the white race, Butler preached the identity doctrine that Anglo-Saxons, not Jews, are the Bible's true chosen people. African Americans are mud people, more animal than human, and the Jews are the offspring of Satan. Although Aryan Nation is primarily a Christian identity group, Butler's anti-Semitism and his calling for the establishment of a white racist state undeniably reflected Nazi-like philosophy. During the 1980s, a number of Aryan nationalist members joined followers of the neo-Nazi National Alliance and some knights of the Ku Klux Klan to form a secret organization called the Silent Brotherhood, also known as the Order, which plotted to overthrow the U.S. government. The Order planned to raise cash to fund the revolution by counterfeiting, robbing banks, and hijacking armored cars. But those drastic measures came to a halt when the death of founder Robert J. Matthews in a shootout with federal agents in December 1984 and the subsequent imprisonment of many members. As Richard Dent's health began to fail, the Aryan Nation's Ohio chapter began positioning itself as a possible headquarters for the group in February 16, 1997, the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, also Vienna Church of Christ in New Vienna, Ohio, and KKK organized a rally at the state capitol of Columbus to protest Black History Month. In September 1997, Ohio's Aryan Nation leader, Harriet Ray Refrain, was sentenced to 6 months in prison for carrying a concealed weapon. All right, I'm just going to hit this chime on this. I'm going to say peace, peace. I hope y'all enjoy it, man. This is what I do. I just get up and read a whole bunch of stuff every day. Find it very fascinating. It tells you what people are doing around you, and everybody needs to get on that King Alpha plan and Rex 84. You got to check that one out. That one's going to blow your cap back. Everybody needs to look into that because that's ongoing. Have a good weekend. Peace, peace.